Today, Marion McPartland's guest is composer-arranger Mercer Ellington, son of the famous Duke Ellington. The Duke passed away in 1974. This program originally aired in 1994.
Mercer, it's great that you're here to do piano jazz with me.
Oh, listen, it's just fine to see you again after, you know, just being able to visit from time to time through the years.
Not often enough, though.
Yeah, I shouldn't be saying through the years. I mean, it's only been about 5 years,
folks. But, you know, it's interesting, though, that you're here on the 20th anniversary of Duke's death, aren't you?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm glad that we're here. And the thing that's great is the exhibit that's going on.
Well, they have done a tremendous job with the Smithsonian and doing the things to let people know various parts of Ellington's career. I went there to the museum, not only in Washington, D.C., but also here in New York, and I found that there were things about the old man that either you forgot or sometimes that somewhere in the articles written about him by other people, you just never realized it yourself. So there's much learning to be gotten as a result of seeing the exhibit.
Even from you, his son.
See, that's true.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. We've eventually feel that we should have the Duke Ellington story done somewhere. We've been discussing the possibility of a motion picture and all. And the question is, what do you say about Duke Ellington and how do you present him, or what kind of a handle do you pick him on? I just don't think that there is any kind of a category to put him into. As you know, he hated categories.
Beyond category,
yes.
As he himself would say.
And it's this kind of a thing that will give us more or less the pulse of what people expect and the interest that lies in his career.
You promised to play play a tune. You promised to play Sea Jam Blues. Are we going to play it or else?
Yeah, why not?
Or what?
I think it kind of goes like this.
That's funny. That tune is really an important tune to me because, as you well remember, we were in Washington in 19... Well, you've got so many things to remember. This may not come to your mind.
Yeah, that's the trouble about getting old.
But no, I didn't mean that. I mean, you've got so many things to remember about your career. But of course, I remember it because it was a big time in my life that I was doing this workshop, a series of workshops in Washington, D.C., and you don't know this, but it had always been my dream that I would do something like this and that I would be able to show these kids some Duke Ellington music, and I would be able to get him down there to perform something. And, of course, at that point in his life, he was not too well. But he came anyway, and you were there, and we had the little band. You had the little band with Jackie Byard.
Oh, yeah.
Rocky
yeah.
was the drummer.
Right.
I forget who the bass player was. Can't remember.
Probably J.J. Wiggins, Jr.
Maybe. But anyway, as sick as he was, he got out there. And I remember you were giving me directions. You said, come on, Maren, you get out there. Or Jackie played first with the small group, and you were sort of taking care of the gig. And then when they were through doing a couple of numbers, Duke came out and played. And, I mean, I think that was the thrill of my life to have him do that for these kids.
Oh, he got a great deal of enjoyment out of it himself because, communication with kids, I think, is one of the most difficult activities that's possible. And it's hard for a lot of people to find out what the procedure is or what the requirements are. It's very simple. It's honesty. You can't kid kids.
You can't kid kids? No, that's absolutely true. Well, because these were grade school. No, some of them were junior high. And, I mean, that tune, Sea Jam Blues, was just made for kids that didn't know that much about music. I mean, all they have to play is... It's such a wonderful tune. And
Bob was great in figuring out how to be ignorant. Because and successfully so. In other words, to be uninhibited. He's got several songs he did like that through his career. Metronome, All Out.
What? How to be ignorant? Is that what you
No, that's what I call ignorant music.
How can you say that?
I mean, one of his foremost statements to me was after I had gone to Juilliard and at a later date studied the Schillinger system in NYU. I was playing and writing much better music before I went to school. So then I had to find a couple of people like Andy Gibson and learn how to be ignorant again.
Oh, that's really funny. But I mean, that was a great time. But and of course, by that time, you were you had been for a while the manager of the band, but you were the manager of the band for a long time before
that,
weren't you?
That was, the way I became the band manager was having an apprenticeship with Cootie Williams after he left Ellington. And he said, you know arithmetic, so you're going to be the manager. And as a result, that meant I could do payrolls and all. And finally, in the years to come, after Al Selle lost his eyesight, they recalled my experience with Cootie because Cootie was back with the band now. And he says, I know the right manager. And he named me, and that's how I got the gig back. And I never knew a job that I disliked as much as that job of being a road manager. Frank Holzfein was invited to take the job.
The owner of the Blue Note.
Yeah. Yes. He said, no, Duke, he said, I'd rather be your friend. And that was great logic. I never understood it at first. But you had to be a detective. You had to insist upon discipline without any endorsement from the boss. You had to know exactly where the various people were and be sure they got to the bus on time. And it was just, a nightmare, actually. So finally I was released and became a trumpet player again.
Well, then who became the band manager after that?
After that, I'd find some patsy and get him to do whatever work was necessary or a statement to be made and got away from it. But that was really, and it plagued me, because years after that, almost every time I saw Charlie Parker, he said, I need a band manager. So I said, Charlie, anything but being the manager. And I really wanted and loved Charlie Parker. I'd like to hang with him all the time, but that would have been a bit much.
Well, when I think of some of the things that you described in your book about like, well, not only getting the guys to the bus, but the conditions some of them would be in, and the thing that always broke me up was with them getting up on the bandstand. That there were certain guys that wanted to be last up on the stand.
Oh yeah, Jimmy Hamilton and Johnny Hodges.
Johnny Hodges and who?
Jimmy Hamilton.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because the logic in the old days was if you got it on the bandstand early, you were worried about being fired and make sure you didn't get the boss angry. And they wanted everybody to know they were so great that they couldn't get fired.
Oh, that's fantastic. I remember also he would be up on the bandstand first and he'd be noodling on the piano and everybody would come sort of trickling up. Slow degrees. God. Oh, I'm just having a great time here. My guest is Mercer Ellington. I'm Marion McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz.
Well, that feud between Johnny Hodges and Jimmy Hamilton helped to create an additional tune, Kind of Dukish, which was really the vamp to Rockin' and Rhythm. And they had to play it, you know, just do anything to play tricks while they got these two in place. Because it left a big hole in the saxophone section, two saxophones out.
Of course, Rockin' I never knew things like that. I mean, I know all these different tunes were written for different reasons, but I didn't know about that one.
Oh,
gee,
yeah.
I don't know if I can play the whole thing all through.
Well, don't play it all through. I just want the folks to recognize what part of it that we're talking about.
I know,
Because they've heard it through the years.
Okay.
The whole thing developed itself. It's like a lot of songs that Ellington played were never written, like Perdido and Caravan. I mean, by the time they got through, they made little licks up and stuff like that. Because in the Cotton Club in the earlier days, they'd bring an act there. And it was always a very great situation for both parties. You'd have an act that didn't have any music. And then you had musicians in the band that couldn't have read it if the music had been. So they'd take a guy like Rubber Legs Williams and say, okay, how about this? And wouldn't you like to do that? And Snape Hips Tucker and the rest. And they would just act, just think of anything, play anything, as long as it fit the act. And that was it. They had a new number and the band played it. And that was it.
Well, who would start a thing like that? Would Duke start on the piano?
Yeah. Because, I mean, just like I said in the book, he was a con man, you know. He was really in the wrong industry. He should have been the man who ballyhooed the circus or something.
Well, he may even have done that in his time. But I'm just trying to think of some other thing. Like, well, Caravan... How did that come about? Was that something?
Well, Tito did the melody, and he said, you know, he used to hear those unusual melodies because in Puerto Rico, where he studied, they were very poor and they couldn't afford too much music. So in order to make them get more practice and get varied compositions, they turned the music upside down. So you get that modal sound that comes from most of the things Tiso's involved in.
I think they're doing that to the music nowadays.
Yeah. So anyhow, they start off and then somebody would put something behind it.
Just start.
That's true.
I mean, like they'd still in like the middle parts. And everybody knew what note to play pretty much, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they wasn't. I don't think there was even a matter of knowledge. It was just a reaction, you know, and they would feel it and then suddenly they'd play whatever it was.
Well, I don't know. Thinking about it, I just feel a tune coming on. I'd just love to play a tune. All these tunes go floating through my head. If I did Prelude to a Kiss, what would that bring back for you in terms of anecdotes or something?
Oh, I don't know. I know it wasn't because I was kissing anybody.
Well, maybe I should find another tune in a sentimental mood.
No, Prelude is lovely. I know one thing about Prelude to a Kiss. I think more people have gotten in trouble playing that song, from playing it and also from singing it, because it sneaks up on you and the range is not really cognizant. I mean, you know, it's pretty wide in its range.
It sure is.
And it's one of the things that the Ellington used, which was much different as the years went through, because of the inversions that he used in composing a song. A lot of stuff is just like ground bass, you know, if you played blues or something like that, the note on the bottom is the name of the chord, but not in Prelude to a Kiss. Be My Guest.
Thank you.
I stuck that last part in. I don't want anybody thinking that Duke... but, you know, that this part, I guess you could get messed up. Let's see.
Much intrigued by that song was Billy Strayhorn, and he wrote a tune which was very, which was almost equally as successful, called "Passion Plow." And as a result, they sort of stuck around and involved the same things. They're very difficult to get the perspective of how it was written, but that's the way it is. Now I think this is one of the most unusual songs Ellington did, save maybe Mood Indigo or something like that. So
that's a great song too. But I love this one. But you just made me think of something very strange. I never have played Passion Flower, and I don't know why, because I do all these Billy Strayhorn things.
Well, it's one of those things where so many things that Billy did, in spite of his fame and popularity, have escaped the audience. I think his day is beginning to blossom now, because we're getting more things like Lush Life and so forth, which have become jazz standards. Having written the songs that sort of were stimulated by Ellington, it led Billy and so many other paths and places to go. Seemingly, you know, you think you know a lot about Billy Strayhorn, and then suddenly, when we were on the festival that was given in celebration of Billy with Lena Horne, and with all the other artists who were there, Henderson and so forth, also the band and various people, and everybody said, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that. And then the next thing you know, they've used up what you consider your idea of presenting Strayhorn. And our policy is that if we're going to be somewhere, we allow the person who has learned something about Duke Ellington to have their preference of what to do, because we should be much more versed in having other options and
you places
mean
to go. What tune they're going to perform.
Right.
Yeah, I see.
So I gave up all the things that everybody mentioned, and that meant that they took Lush Life first of all. I was one of the first ones to go.
Of course.
And
they did.
By the time they got through, I really had to dig, and I had to go into things that were a combination of tunes that either Billy had done by himself or had done at an early stage of his career that they weren't familiar with, like My Little Brown Book.
See, now that's one I don't know.
Right.
After All?
Right, After All. And then there's another thing he did called Skilly Poop.
Don't know it.
For Manhattan Medical Group. Yeah, so it made us dig into the various things of Billy's. Another song they took was Chelsea Bridge.
Oh, I love that.
Which I wanted to do that. You know, this is a question you can answer for me. They say when, and incidentally, it's the artist situation. He wrote it as a theme song for Red Sinus in Chicago, Club de Lisa, the last
place. The drummer, Red Sand.
Yeah.
Red Saunders. Oh,
yeah.
Goodness. Yeah.
Anyhow, they said that Billy was high and he was standing on the wrong bridge when he was inspired by Chelsea Bridge. And I don't know whether you know anything about that or not.
No, I didn't. But that's a funny thing to say about that tune, because the tune is so romantic and gorgeous sounding.
Well, you know, this is one of the most, I would say, sensational things about Strayhorn. Here's a man who was, you know, working in a drugstore in a very outlandish spot, unromantic, because it was filled at that time with a lot of smoke and stuff from the steel industry. I'm talking about Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes all of these lovely scenes that took place in Paris. You know, and show you where the imagination goes.
Can I do that one, Chelsea Bridge? I'd love to do that.
I'd love to hear it. now you have Strayhorn. You know, he gets a beautiful thought of Chelsea Bridge in London while we're standing on the corner waiting for a jitney in Chicago.
He just destroyed my dream.
And then he does Lush Life while he's punching sodas in Pittsburgh.
God.
And talks about Paris.
I used to love it, it's funny when I think of it now. Duke would be in one end of the Hickory House having dinner with maybe Evie and Joe Morgan. Mm-hmm. And Billy Strayhorn would be up near the piano sitting at the bar. Like the two of them would be there, but in different spots.
Yeah, that's right.
And I would be trying to learn all these Billy Strayhorn tunes, especially because he was there. And he was so sweet. And every time I played one, he would compliment me, even though I probably was playing the wrong changes. Oh, boy. Well, this is really a fabulous time for me to be sitting here talking with my guest. My guest is Mercer Ellington. I'm Marion McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. When did you get into writing yourself?
Well, I don't remember. It's like I don't remember the day that I became an arranger or the day that I could consider myself a trumpet player or whatever.
But how about the piano? Didn't Duke show you things at the piano?
I had my piano lessons from him, which I think stuck.
You had piano lessons from him?
Yeah. And I
but to, when?
About four or five of them in 1941.
No kidding.
When he had time enough to fool around a little bit more than normally because we were doing Jump for Joy.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give me a problem, put it on a piece of paper and say, okay, work on this. And he'd go out to Casa Manana, play, come back in, correct the paper. He wouldn't correct it as such. If he disagreed with anything, he'd just erase the notes. And it was up to me to find something that he wouldn't disagree with. Which was my next day's lesson.
That's amazing.
Well, and I think about him being on my shoulder all the time.
Well, you, somewhere in your long and varied career, you wrote quite a number of tunes. And when did you write that one, Moon Mist? That's a really pretty song.
That was 1941. That was one
was
of
that
my
one
first
of your
lessons.
Piano lessons?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You know, I tried to play that thing. I don't know if I can play it. I'd love to try.
Please.
And if I... You know, you may have to correct me when I get through. All right,
it goes. Come on. See, nobody told me that I wasn't supposed to write fast an octave in order to write a melody. So here we have one that stretches all over the place.
But the melody is so intriguing, though. And I know it should be in rhythm, and it's got wonderful voicings, but, you know, it goes... That's the one I had trouble with. Didn't get that nice voicing, but
well, you know, I'll give you an idea of what we were about when we worked at that. The lesson started off with him saying, well, okay, put two notes together. If they sound good, keep them. And then get two more notes and put them together. And if they sound good, keep them. And then put the two one behind the other. He said, now you must write a melody that is not repeating any of the notes you've used. And you'll find that generally speaking throughout that song, that the notes in the song are not in the chords.
God, this part got me. That amazes me. Then it goes, this part. I couldn't find a chord to... Well, next time you see me, I'll be playing this thing.
Well, that's just, I mean, like, for instance, you know, in order to do this, you find yourself having to write an E-flat up against the E-natural and doing the various things.
Yeah, well, because he's keeping
because you can't use a note that exists in the chord.
He goes on down.
Yeah.
You know, he's got
behind it.
Well.
So, Moon Mist was really, like, basically the first lesson I had.
Fantastic.
But it took about a month to write it.
Fantastic.
And the thing that's so disgusting, you know, you write that beautiful composition, you think, and it's so wonderful and all like that. And you figure, okay, well, now I'm in the club with Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington and different people who have good taste. And one night you go out and you get drunk and you write a tune like things ain't what they used to be, and it becomes a smash in 20 minutes.
It's incredible because that tune has meant, well, of course, Duke used it as his theme song, didn't he, at one period. And I, with a lot of nerve, I would use that too in clubs. In fact, I still do.
It's still very effective for us.
It's a wonderful tune. Just so people know what we're talking about, can I play that little bit
of
that tune?
I would love to play.
Well, let's see. I've heard it in D flat. I think maybe I'll try it there.
All right. That's the original key, incidentally.
I just changed my mind.
Because that was a good key for Johnny Hodges.
Oh, is that why?
Oh, yeah. Johnny loved A flat and D flat.
Well, I never knew that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, here goes then.
Thank you.
hard. It's easier with the rhythm section.
But
you know, I would play that tune, talking about doing things with kids. I would play that tune for kids, and they just love it. And walk out kind of swinging, you know, you get the little kids.
Well, there again, I mean, you know, like I say, is the value of ignorance. You see?
The value of ignorance. You can't call that being ignorant because it's such a catchy melody.
In fact, we don't say ignorance. We just say ignorant. Because in order to develop the feel for the music, you got to have be just that dumb in your speech. So, yeah.
It's too late for Duke.
What he did, he gave me all the funky assignments. You know, like when the twist came in, I had to do a thing called a taffy twist, and it wound up being the big number for the colleges and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's great. But things ain't what they used to be. That's a great blues. I mean, you just can't miss with that one. But is that what happened? You wrote it in like 20 minutes?
Yeah. He called up one morning. He knew I had been out messing around. He said, I got a record date at 9 o'clock. I need one more tune. And I got up because I'd been screaming at him and telling him he was favoring Strayhorn, and I never got a chance to write anymore. So I knew if I let him get away with this one, he'd never have to worry about it. So I got whatever it was I could throw together and raced down there and got it in.
God, well, you have spent your whole life being dedicated to doing things for this man. I mean, really, it's amazing.
You have to really be careful. Is that you don't wind up doing the same thing to your children. What I have to worry about, like, for instance, Merce Dees and Gay and Paul and Edward and so forth, that, I mean, I don't wind up just pushing them back or ignoring them or taking them for granted. And
so you really learned that?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing you got to watch, because you sit and you criticize your parents, and the next thing you know, you are them.
Yeah, boy, that's pretty profound. Yeah. Wow. In case you've just tuned in, my guest today is Mercer Ellington. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. You know, I just thought of something. In all the years Duke Ellington had the band, which is like 64 of something years later, you won a Grammy with your record of Digital Duke.
You know, the funniest thing, the ironic thing, is that we were trying to establish a continuance of the Ellington Orchestra. And constantly being criticized, oh, well, you'll never make it. And, we can tell the old man's not here. Every once in a while, you get one of your frank friends who would, you know, be very happy to make your life miserable.
So-called friends.
Yeah. And finally, we make our great record, which is, like you say, Digital Duke. And when... And then you hear it being played on the radio one day, and they said, this is the Duke Ellington band. And then they start talking about all the members of the old band who were playing this and that. And you don't get recognized because you sound too much like him. That was our problem.
Oh, God, you mean they were calling out the names of the guys who were?
A couple of members in the Duke Ellington Society said, I don't remember this version of Mood Indigo with Duke. They were still thinking he was.
They were still
piano.
Thinking it was him, but in reality, that was your thing, which was great.
Well, I mean, I tried to live up to the title that he gave me. He said I was keeper of the flame. So the only thing to do is to play Ellington like Ellington and to be Ellington, and not to. Before that, I was busy trying to bust down doors and establish an identity and a career for myself, and this way. It's enough to, it's not one person who is the career anymore, it's two people. And in order to make it last and to have an effect, then you have to do it the way we're doing it.
Well, after everything you've been talking about, I I feel a tune coming on, but it isn't anything that's ever been heard before by anybody, because I thought what I'd like to do is do a sort of piano portrait of you. Can I just totally off the cuff? Can I do that?
I'll pose. Let's say I have this position.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to pose. It'll just be you as I know you for these many years.
All right. Well, I think it's one of the most flattering things that I've ever had happen to me. I certainly love you all the more for it.
Well, I love doing it for you, and it was totally as I told you. I just thought of it as I went along. But you know what I was thinking? I'm thinking, why can't I do what Duke told Mercer to do, which was no two notes.
Well, you will be doing it. I feel that I've sort of tweaked your curiosity, and I can see you working at it.
No, it's true. I am. I'll be thinking about that for a long time, and then, in fact, it'll probably influence whatever little ditties I may write in the future. I'll be thinking about that. You know, I just feel I'd like to play one more tune. You pick one for me.
Oh, I think it'd be nice if you did In My Solitude.
Now, why do you especially pick that one?
Well, we're talking about the various categories in which Ellington wrote. And it took him some time to get the courage, or maybe it wasn't courage, but to get the verve to really reach inside himself and finally give away one thought which he normally kept obscure. And that was his thoughts about God. And I think the first attempt at this was in My Solitude, when especially in his voice in the last lines, "Dear Lord above, send back my love."
Hmm.
The first time he used the deity in his music.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. See, you've done something for me again, because then I'll always be thinking about that any time I play this tune.
Good. That was gorgeous.
Thank you. You know, it's been such a kick I've been looking forward to this for a long time, Mercer.
After having had the joy and the wonderful time here, I'm inviting you to come and be with us at your next possible moment.
Okay. I will accept gratitude.
Very good.
Okay.
You got a gig.
Okay. At last, I've got a gig.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland and her guest, Mercer Ellington. This program originally aired in 1994. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Andrew Milano, mastering engineer Bill Sexton, production manager Gene Pinkston, executive producer Tom Clark. We love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1101 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. To find out more about the artists and music selections heard on Piano Jazz, or to listen to a recent program, visit our website, pianojazz.npr.org. There you'll also find a link to our free weekly preview podcast, Piano Jazz Shorts. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the Friends of Piano Jazz, and from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And from Save America's Treasures, through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. The original program was made possible by a grant from Exxon Corporation. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.